Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll, and the only place besides the Guns N' Roses dressing room or bus where you can hear the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling. Hope you're doing good. Everybody's listening, doing good. Listen, I was driving over to my studio today, where I'm at right now. I was driving over, and there was a sign on the side of the road with a guy sitting there. It said, lobster tails, $2. So I pulled over, gave the guy my $2, and he started the story. Once upon a time, there was a lobster. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
That's awful. My producer, Stacy, loved it, but I thought that was terrible. But thanks, Duff, for never missing a Friday and for always trying to make us laugh. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But if you're looking for more laughs, check out the latest episode of the Winnipeggers. We release new episodes every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on my Facebook page and YouTube channel. And this week, Ribo, Dave, and I talk about festivals, music festivals, the crazy experiences we've had. You'll hear what happened to Fozzie at a small festival in Kansas. Dave has a great story about sneaking into a festival in Winnipeg, and Ribo has played and attended his fair share of fests as well, some with no people. Dave's also ranting about flash mobs. What year is this? Come laugh along with us or at us. Winnipeggers, new episodes every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern on Facebook and my YouTube channel. All right, today, a little bit creepy. I got Jay Wasley from Ghost Adventures, which airs on the Discovery Plus app and channel. He's part of Talk is Jericho alumni Zach Bagan's crew, and Jay came on to talk about the infamous haunted and creepy Cecil Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. The Cecil's the subject of a new documentary on Netflix called Crime Scene, Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, which explores the weird circumstances around Elisa Lam's disappearance and death. Was it murder? Was it suicide? Was it something otherworldly? Well, Jay and the Ghost Adventures crew did their own 10-day investigation at the Cecil that they turned into a two-hour TV special. And they have their own theories about what may have happened to Elisa Lam. But that's not all Jay and the Ghost Adventures boys covered. They also investigated other gruesome murders, suicides, strange occurrences at the Cecil. Serial killer Richard Ramirez lived there while he was terrorizing Southern California in the 80s. And they had some interesting experiences in his room. Jay spent some time down in the basement by himself in the dark, and what he encountered there will make your skin crawl. So let's do it. Creepy, scary, paranormal ghost stories from the Cecil Hotel with Jay Wasley, starting now on Talk is Jericho. So one of the hot new shows on Netflix is the Cecil Hotel mystery and the whole story of Elisa Lam. And wanted to do a little bit more of an in-depth look into the Cecil, so I contacted my old friends at Ghost Adventures with Zach Bagans, and now Jay Wasley is here to discuss your recent encounter, because you guys just did a whole special on being inside the Cecil Hotel.
Oh yeah, it was pretty groundbreaking too, because we were the first televised paranormal investigation of the hotel. I mean, I'm sure people have stayed there and kind of secretly did their own investigations, but the Cecil's always been against it. Like, even every time we would film in LA, we would always go there and be like, hey, can we film here? We want to do an episode for years now. And they've always just shut us down, never wanted it. And we got lucky this time. I don't know if it's because of the pandemic and things are shut down, and they're like, kind of like, if you're going to do it, now's the time to do it. And we were able to get in there.
So this is something you guys have wanted to explore even before the Netflix documentary came out?
Yeah, definitely way before. We've wanted to. I think we first went there when we were doing the Black Dahlia case. We were doing a house in L.A. where they think that she might have been murdered. And we were kind of tracing her last steps, and they said the last spot she was actually seen was at the Cecil Hotel lobby bar. So we actually went over there, and that was when we first said, hey, can we film here sometime? And like I said, they just shut us down and wanted nothing to do with us.
Well, for those who don't know, let's explain a little bit about what the Cecil Hotel is and a little bit of its history, because it's one of those places that I've been in L.A. 100 times, and as soon as you hear the Cecil, you're like, I think I know where that is. All right. But now everyone knows where it is exactly. But kind of tell us a little bit what's so special about that place.
Yeah, the Cecil Hotel, it's just kind of had this since it first built. I think it was about 1924 it was first built. And it was a kind of a higher-end hotel. But then the late 20s, the Great Depression hit, and basically Skid Row started happening, which is, if you're not familiar, it's the downtown part of L.A. where a lot of the homeless camp out and hang out. So this just became kind of an area real quick that was just, you know, crime, drugs, and prostitution, and kind of people that were always down and out. And unfortunately, with that, the Cecil kind of took that as well. And the first thing was suicides were starting to happen right away. People taking pills, killing themselves, jumping out windows, and actually it became known as the Suicide Hotel. That's what people started nicknaming it.
Really?
Yeah, which is pretty wild to think, you know, it started out as this high-end, classy hotel, and then within, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years, it was known as the Suicide Hotel.
Yeah, because it started out, like you mentioned, like of kind of a classy, upscale hotel in the middle of downtown L.A. back in the, you know, pre-Depression times, which now things have changed to where it is in the middle of basically Skid Row, where, and you'll see this in the documentary, there's hundreds of people with no homes and nowhere to live kind of in the same area. So if you stay there nowadays, well, it's closed now, but when it was open, you know, you take a right and you're right in the middle of drug infested poverty. So it's definitely got a lot of, and I know from doing other shows on ghosts and doing my own investigations, the kind of the bad vibes and the bad, you know, suffering and the pain and that sort of thing is kind of where a little bit more ghost activity takes place to begin with. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that energy sticks, you know, it's just such an extreme release of negative energy. It's just going to kind of stain the walls, stain the grounds. And that energy, it just, you can feel it. As soon as we walked in there, just being in there, and we had the entire place to ourselves, it's 15 floors. Everywhere you go, you just feel this repressive, dark energy. It was actually pretty overwhelming at times. We would be doing interviews, and during the interviews, people we're talking to just had to get out. They're just like, I can't do this. I got to get out of this room. And they would just leave in the middle of it.
And just to explain that to people, go, oh, okay, whatever. So when I did something for the Travel Channel where we were looking for some of the swamp monsters in the bayous of New Orleans and all that sort of thing, and there was an area where a bunch of people had died and were buried, and in the middle of the investigation, I felt like the fight or flight, like my insides started feeling a little bit weird as if I had just gotten off of a roller coaster. But the one thing instinctually was like, get the fuck out of here. This is not cool. I remember I even said to the director, this is not fun. This is not good. And so it's something that you actually real physically experience.
Yeah, you feel it in your body, and it's you know, unfortunately it's hard to translate sometimes on television, but it's there. You feel it, and that's what we like to do. Once we start feeling those things, that's when we tend to bring out our different devices, different ways to measure what's going on, to try to capture evidence of what's going on. But it usually starts with a feeling at first.
And once again too, if you guys watch American Horror Story, the Cecil Hotel is what they based the season hotel on. So it's got a very nice kind of expansive lobby. But as you go upstairs into the room, it's basically turned into a really kind of a cheap hotel. And one of the things with the documentary is they have people that have stayed there and just how bad the conditions were and all that sort of thing. But when you guys are in there, completely empty, like you said, 15 floors. I mean, that's creepy just to start off.
Just alone, any hotel completely abandoned would be kind of creepy. Oh. But it was wild because we knew, you know, where our team was. We were always together and we'd be filming and you just hear footsteps down the hall. You hear people, doors opening and shutting. And we're like, all right, there's got to be more people in here. So then we would walk around and try to check. Nothing. We would check with the, you know, we had one maintenance guy that was kind of our guide. That was kind of like if we needed doors unlocked, things like that. He was the only one there from the hotel too. And he would be like, no, everybody's gone. This is all cleared out. But I swear, man, we would hear people walking, talking, footsteps, doors opening and slamming all the time. It was so much where it was like, all right, there's got to be someone else in here, but there wasn't.
Okay, but you've been on the Ghost Adventures crew for a while, so you must be getting kind of used to it because you're looking for this stuff. You're asking for trouble.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, every other week for almost 11 years now I've been doing it. It's wild, man. But it's still, you know, I talk about it sometimes where I like, you know, we've experienced so much, we've seen so much. Like, what else could there be? What else is going to be like, oh, my God? But we'll experience things that still just blow my mind to this day. And I try to still approach everything slightly skeptically. I try to figure out, all right, what is it? What's going on? How could this be? And there's still plenty of times where just my mind is blown.
So let's talk about some of the more evil incidents and people that have stayed at the Cecil, which made you so curious to try and get in there to investigate.
Yeah, one of the big one was the infamous Night Stalker killer, Richard Ramirez, who obviously, as many people know now, there's a lot about him going on now. He was just a brutal, evil serial killer, just sadistic. He was actually a Satan worshiper as well. He started in El Paso, Texas, and he would actually sleep out in a cemetery out there, which we got to investigate a while back. So we always kind of, you know, we made that connection with him. So it was kind of wild to now go to the place where he was actually killing in L.A. and he was staying at the Cecil Hotel. And obviously, it's not 100% confirmed, but there's a lot of people that claim and say that he was actually doing satanic rituals up on the roof and in the hotel as well. So that just piqued our interest. I mean, you have someone that evil, that, you know, unfortunately in tune with such a dark level of energy, that's got to do something. Just that alone is going to bring a whole, you know, swarm of evil energy to that place. And what's crazy, too, is even after he left and he ultimately got arrested and ended up dying in jail, people have gone to the Cecil Hotel. There's like this whole weird thing where people want to mimic serial killers, where they want to kind of, there's like this weird fascination about it. And they'll actually go to the Cecil Hotel and try to perform their own rituals and things. And I've heard of stories about people getting kicked out and, you know, pushed away because they're actually going there trying to do that stuff.
Well, no, it's crazy. You know, you talk about Richard Ramirez. He had like groupies when he was on trial. And like you mentioned, I mean, a place like the Cecil attracts a lot of weird people that want to be, you know, around this sort of a vibe. So you're saying that Ramirez actually stayed at the hotel while he was committing his murders?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, right before he was arrested. I think that was the last spot he was staying at.
And there's other people too that I know in the documentary talking about Pigeon Goldie.
Yeah. Yeah, she was a brutal murder that happened, still kind of unexplained. You know, they're not sure what happened. They just found her in her room and she was just brutally murdered. You know, it was just like horror scene. You know, when she was discovered.
And another serial killer stayed there as well?
Yeah, it was, I forget his name. It was actually, but he was from Austria.
Jack Unterweger.
Yeah, and he was actually, he was a fan of Richard Ramirez.
So wow.
He committed murders back in Austria, actually went to jail. I don't know how, somehow served some time, got out of jail, came over to L.A., I think as a journalist, to kind of write stories about things. And then he ended up basically copycatting Richard Ramirez and committing his own crimes.
And staying at the Cecil.
Yeah, and staying at the Cecil, the hotel. So, I mean, it is. It's like a magnet for just negative energy. It's such a wild place.
And the most modern one that everyone's talking about is Elisa Lam, who, when you watch the documentary, it seems that there's no real answer as to how she ended up in the water tank. Mm-hmm. On the roof, and then now they kind of surmise that she basically had really bad depression and basically committed suicide by jumping into the water tank. So there's all that storyline as well.
Yeah, which that is just, it's one of those cases where it just doesn't make any sense. You know, yes, she had depression, some bipolar, and maybe that could have played into it. But there's still, when you think about it, if someone's in that state and being there and actually being there and be able to walk her path that she would have had to take in to get to the water tanks, there's no way someone in that mindset would do that calculated route to get all the way up there, take off all her clothes, climb up onto the top of the water tank, which isn't necessarily an easy thing to do, lift open the heavy gate, or not that gate, it's like a big lid, you know, that shuts down onto the tank. So she would have had to lift open that lid, jump into the water, and then on top of that, still somehow reach up out of the tank, grab the heavy lid, pull it up and down to shut it. Like, I just don't see how anybody could do that. And if she was, you know, depressed and wanting to kill herself, she could have jumped off. You know, there's windows, there's plate. Like, yeah. It would have been, you know, it's sad to say, but it would have been way easier ways to do it. And two, there was a report she was buying gifts the day of that her, when she was last seen in that elevator footage, she was actually seen at a bookstore buying gifts to bring home. So it's definitely not something that was premeditated. She wasn't planning to kill herself, because who would buy, you know, souvenirs right. to bring home if they're planning to kill themselves?
It's interesting, too, because the once again, for people that haven't seen it, the water tank is accessible, obviously, from a staircase to the roof, but I think that was locked. The way that they said that she climbed was basically a fire escape on the outside of the building. And like you mentioned, it's 15 floors up. And this fire escape, I mean, I don't know how you are with heights, but just climbing that ladder, I mean, you've got to be completely insane, which we're saying she was depressed, but that's a lot of work to jump into a freaking water tank.
Exactly. And too, I heard too, they said that she didn't have her glasses. Her glasses were never found. So,
and they're in the room. Oh, they're okay. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe they were in her room eventually, but she didn't have them at least when she was in the tank. So that means even if she was doing all this crazy climbing, she was doing that without her glasses on top of all that, which is just, I don't know. I don't buy it that she did it on purpose. I think, you know, it's hard to say exactly. I don't know if people influenced her, and with the history, you know, we knowing it's a bad place, unfortunately, and like a lot of the copycat killers, things like that, who knows if people were taking advantage of her or just, you know, being there. Like I said, with the interviews, bugging out, walking out of the interviews while we were there, we had emotions flying. We would get agitated and aggressive and angry at different times. You know, so I could see how someone staying there that is in a fragile state, that has, you know, depression or bipolar, you know, could almost be influenced by the negative energies that are there to help her ultimately end up in the water tank.
So let's continue on with the subject. So when you go to the Cecil, is one of the missions you have to try and find some evidence or some sort of contact with Elisa Lam?
Yeah, that was our one of our main focuses, because it's such a big hotel with so much history. We kind of wanted to break it down into kind of, all right, what is our main focus? And obviously one of them was Elisa Lam, and then our other focus was Richard Ramirez. So gotcha. First we kind of focused on Elisa Lam and kind of dove into her story, retraced her steps. And we actually found what room she was staying in, which was kind of weird because she was staying in a room that was a shared room at first, kind of like a hostel style. And then the people she was staying with were complaining to the hotel that she was being really right. weird and stuff. And so they switched her to a private room. So we found that private room. We went in there. We, you know, focused a lot of the investigation on that as well. And while they were in there, I was at Nerve Center monitoring, and over trying to remember, I think it was the spirit box or the Polterpod, but a voice came through and it actually said Elisa Lam, clear as day, came through while we were in her room, which is, you know, like, I don't know, part of me understand, you know, doing the paranormal for so long, residual evidence makes sense to me that, you know, there's a loop of energy that, you know, you walk down the same hallway every day of your life, a bit of your energy flows up and down of that hallway, you know. That makes sense. And then under the right circumstances, you can capture a little of that energy just kind of still circulating around. But when you get something that's intelligent like that, that's actually saying a name of a person that stayed in that room that mysteriously died, that takes it to a whole other level. I'm like, all right, this is something intelligent. This is something that's actually directly trying to communicate with us or try to give us messages, you know, and that was, we were pretty blown away by that one. And I'm trying to remember, I think in the hallway too of her room, we call it a dark shadow figure on a full spectrum photo. It was totally unexplained. We tried to debunk it. We went through, you know, and that's the one thing, when we do get evidence, we don't just say, oh, all right, we got evidence. We'll actually dig deep and we'll try to figure out, all right, you know, is there some way this could have been explained? You know, how could we figure this out? And
so explain, what did you have a photograph that you had taken?
I believe it was Zach that actually took it. It was a full spectrum photo. So what it does, it basically, it's a camera that sees in all types of light. So when we see, we just see white light. But we know there's infrared, there's full spectrum UV light, things like that. Right. So this camera sees in all frequencies of light, and it picked up, there's this full on shadow figure kind of up down the hall, not too far from Lisa Lam's room. You know, and it kind of just plays into the whole idea that maybe there was something dark that's influencing, you know, not just her, but a lot of people in that hotel to maybe commit suicide. You know, it's weird that so many people go there to end their lives. You know, I think there's got to be something there that's drawing them, or if not even drawing them, then something that evil's there is feeding off of it. And, you know, definitely causing havoc.
Go back a little bit when you talked about hearing Elisa Lam off the spirit box. Explain what a spirit box is.
So basically, there's a few different spirit boxes we use. But basically what they do, they scan through radio frequencies. And they scan so quickly that, you know, when you hear it, it kind of is like a ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And each little ch is basically a frequency. And, you know, you'll get a response. Like, we'll say, is anyone here? Things like that. And the thing is that's crazy about it, like, skeptics can be like, oh, it could be radio interference, things like that. But it sweeps so quick. And when you get a phrase like Elisa Lam, you could actually put it in the computer and look at it. And you could see that the Elisa Lam spans over at least 20 plus stations. You know what I mean? It's not just one little quick blip. It's going across a whole series of frequencies. So there's no way that it's interference. And the theory is that, you know, basically the other world, spirits, you know, the energy over there can actually communicate through these different frequencies. And that's what we do a lot. We try to experiment with different frequencies and, you know, the photo world and audio world to try to capture things that, you know, we don't necessarily experience daily because it's outside of our normal hearing and viewing.
So when you mentioned you kind of retraced her last steps, did you obviously go into the elevator and oh, yeah. hang out in there?
Yeah, I know Zach went in the elevator first because there was a whole kind of belief, which I don't know, I kind of doubt she was doing that. There was this thing called the elevator game. I think it came from Korea where if you go into a hotel and, you know, or just an elevator, I guess, and you punch the keys in a certain combination, it kind of opens up a portal kind of thing.
Really?
Yeah, it's a whole thing. It's pretty wild. I don't know, you know, too much about it, but we heard about that. And there was kind of people were like, oh, maybe that's what she was doing, you know, but kind of watching the elevator footage of Elisa Lam, you could see that's not, she's not actually punching the numbers in the right order and things like that.
It's just kind of slid it all down the middle, right. 1, 2, 3,
yeah.
4.
So, but Zach wanted to try it out. So he went in and he tried the elevator game, which, you know, I give him credit for going in there and just doing that by himself. Right. You know, first time we've ever tried to experience that. And I don't know if he captured evidence, but I know personally he did have an experience where he felt like this rush of energy get on the elevator at one point, and it was enough to definitely creep him out. And then later on in the investigation, when we were actually doing our lockdown, I got to investigate the elevator by myself for a while, and I was just kind of sitting there. I had a binaural microphone, which is basically it's a 3D microphone system. It simulates human hearing, so it's the most accurate to human hearing that you can record in. And I'm just, you know, trying to communicate, trying to get answers. It's, you know, I want to communicate with Elisa Lam. I'm not trying to, you know, fight off anything evil at that point. So I'm just trying to be calm and communicate. And, you know, and then eventually nothing's really happening. So I decide to go up the floors, just hit all the buttons. I go up and it was on the 15th floor, which is where you would have to get roof access. You know, I got off and I heard this weird dragging sound and I looked out the elevator. No one was there. Nothing's there. There shouldn't be. We're by ourselves. And now we're actually doing our official investigation. So we make sure, you know, even our production crew, they're all outside. Like, we have the entire building, just the four of us to ourselves. And I hear dragon coming down the hallway. So I'm peeking around. I don't see anything. And as I'm getting back in the elevator, I hear a clear as woman voice, which I also captured on audio, saying hello. Like, she was saying hello to me. It was clear as day. It creeped me out. And I, you know, was kind of in the process of getting back in the elevator, and then the door shut and I went back down. And after we reviewed that, it's, you know, it's so clear. If you watch the special, it's straight a woman saying hello on the 15th floor, which I can't explain it because I looked out there. There's nobody there. You know, that was pretty wild.
No, it's absolutely wild. And once again, I think when you guys go into these places, I'm sure you've gone to plenty of places and not had any type of evidence or anything like that. So when you have, you know, that sort of a voice come up, it must be kind of a little bit of a small victory for you guys.
Oh yeah. It's always a rush and exciting. And, you know, we put a lot into it and we tend to get, you know, be able to draw out evidence. I don't know if it's just from doing it so long, we kind of know how to focus ourselves. And I think there's just something about the four of us too, when we get together, maybe it's like each individual's energy that kind of come together and we just were able to draw this stuff out. And, you know, but you're right, there are times where things are slower. It's kind of fishing, you know, like, you know, when you right. watch an episode, it's 40 minutes, but we're there for almost a week, you know, right. you know, we're just showing you the highlights, really.
How long were you guys in the Cecil for?
We were there, it was probably roughly about 10 days-ish.
10 days straight?
Yeah, I mean, maybe a day off here and there, but usually when we film an episode, we usually do, you know, 5 days, including travel. But for this, we wanted to focus a little extra and make it a 2-hour special, so we basically doubled that.
So what are you kind of feeling, and what did Zach and the boys feel about Elisa? Because you see her in the elevator, she's acting very sporadic, very strange. I mean, you see what could be somebody else's foot. You're mentioning how that trip to the water tank is a lot of work and a lot of danger into the almost impossible situation of throwing yourself into the water tank and closing the lid as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, we all, and it was a constant debate. We didn't want to just settle on one thing. We didn't want to go into it kind of already thinking things. We wanted to go in there and experience it in real time and try to figure this out, you know, like a detective would, if you will. And we debated a lot of things. We're just like, oh, what about this? What about this? And, you know, really, you know, we got some answers. We definitely got communication. There were moments where, like, we kind of feel overall, and I think it does lend to the overall experience of the Cecil, and the feeling is that whatever she was going through, that we do believe that she was being affected by something supernatural. And because there's, like I said, there's no way she could have done it by herself. And just being there, you feel it. There's no denying anyone that walks in that building, especially if it's empty or even if it's just slow and they have some time by themselves and they're in there, you know, you can feel it. You just feel it's not right in there. So I can imagine how easily it could be for someone to be, you know, manipulated in a spiritual sense there.
Somebody with a weaker mental state could be, like you said, manipulated by something otherworldly that's in the hotel.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when you watch the elevator footage, I mean, it looks like she's seeing something. You know, she is kind of having weird mannerisms and acting a little weird, but she's looking at something. She's frightened. She's, you know, you could see those things. Like, she's seeing something there, you know. And I think that's the thing. I think a lot of people, you know, even like with children, you know, the mind is at a different place than we do as, you know, as we grow and become adults. So like, children tend to see spirits. They tend to have experience, you know, imaginary friends, things like that.
Right.
And then as we grow up, real life kicks in, you get a job, you do all that, and you kind of, you lose that connection you do. But I find that a lot of people that have certain, you know, mental conditions, maybe that allows you in a sense to be more open or more perspective, you know, change your perspective a little bit to be more open to seeing those kind of things.
Well, too, we have a tendency as adults to just not believe anything. You know, you hear something, you know, it's just the water pipes, you know, the house is shifting. Like, what the f*** does that mean, right?
Right.
Whereas a kid or somebody that's, you know, in a depleted mental state might have a more open mind to what it really is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. Well, you know, we've done cases too where, like, you know, we've gone to old abandoned mental hospitals and we hear stories about the patients seeing things and having things. You know, we, you know, as society always chalk it up to be like, oh, they're just crazy. They're, you know, they're seeing things, but maybe they're not. Maybe they're kind of tuned into a different wavelength and they're actually able to experience these things. You know, it kind of makes you rethink that kind of stuff and kind of feel bad
absolutely
for them if they are actually seeing these things.
So what else did you investigate while you were in there?
So, yeah, so after that, and we kind of touched on a little bit of everything, but the next main focus was Richard Ramirez's room. Once again, we found the room that he was staying in, and that's one place particular where, you know, like I said, the whole hotel alone, you walk in there and you're just like, all right, this is evil, this is messed up. You walk into that room and it's like, all right, this feels kind of like the epicenter of what's going on here. Like, just it's condensed there, you know, it's even more so. And then what was crazy, you know, before getting to Richard's stuff, but like, we found out a lot of, which I guess this would predate Richard Ramirez being there, like there was a murder and a rape across the hall in that room. And we started finding, like, all these stories, like, in the rooms kind of right around where Richard Ramirez stayed. There was all these gruesome stories of...
After he had stayed there?
No, this was actually before. So it was kind of interesting that out of all the rooms in this 15-floor massive hotel that Richard Ramirez could have stayed in, he stays in the room that's kind of surrounded by all this gruesome history, which I can't imagine he knew that, because who's, you know, they would never talk about that back then and give that information out. You know, so it's just kind of weird that it kind of goes back to that whole, there's something there that's drawing people to it.
But Zach told me before, he was on early in the history of Talk is Jericho, but he said there's certain people that are kind of conduits for this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at someone like Ramirez, who's pure evil, maybe, you know, by the evil happenstance was just put in that position because that's where all, like you said, the epicenter of all of these dark spirits and entities were.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, no doubt that Rich Ramirez was connected to evil, just pure evil. Yeah. So it makes sense that he would be drawn to evil, you know, like kind of draws like, you know.
Yes.
You know, so it makes sense that, you know, it's kind of, you know, ironic in a way, but it's true. It makes sense that that's the place he would be.
So continue on. So you found his room.
Yeah. So we went in there and we brought in a couple, a psychic couple with us, the Perrys, Michael, Marty Perry, who are a really unique couple. One of them actually draws, you know, she sees spirits and then she'll actually draw their picture, which is pretty cool. It's kind of a unique thing. And then the other one communicates with them. So we kind of, we split them up and, you know, they didn't know. They obviously, the CISO tell you can't hide the history. It's somewhat known. But we didn't tell them what rooms they were going to, things like that. And, you know, we split them up and we kind of walked around with them, just kind of. And then when we finally brought them together, Michael walked into, we had Marty, which is a, she was staying in Richard Ramirez's room. She didn't know it was his room. Mm. And it's weird because as Michael walks into the room, first thing he says, he's like, oh, hey, killer. Like, to his wife, you know, just kind of nonchalantly, be like, oh, hey, killer. But it was like, really? Like, you know, like, I don't know what nicknames they have for each other and things back home.
Right,
but,
right,
like,
right.
It was, we were just kind of like, wait, what? Like, why did you just say, what's up, killer? Like, as you walked into Richard Ramirez's room, which they didn't know that's where they were. And he responded, he's like, oh, I don't know. It just kind of felt like it just came out. Like, he didn't even, try to say it. So that was pretty wild. And then Marty was talking about how she was saying, like, she wants to know who the bad person is in here. Like, she picked up that there was a bad person. She didn't actually get the name and things, but she straight up felt it too, which, you know, it was cool to, you know, that's the best thing when we go in, you feel these things, but to have other people, you know, don't tell them anything, and they go in there and they feel the same energy and feel the same kind of vibe, you know, so that was really cool to have that. Then we went around, we went to different rooms, and there was a point where Michael was feeling that Rich Ramirez was there and was kind of like, kind of laughing at us a little bit and kind of thought it was kind of humorous that we're trying to find him and try to figure it out. You know, so that was kind of cool. And then right as that was happening, I remember I was filming and I was standing right behind Zach, and on the back of Zach's neck, kind of on the side, he just started getting this really big red welt started to form. And it was weird because Michael, like, pointed at Zach and he's like, oh, he wants you. Like, talking about Rich Ramirez wanting Zach. And then right as it's happening, and I'm like, all right, Zach, just don't freak out. But there's something, you know, something's appearing on the back of your neck. And then after that, it kind of spread around and he had, like, this weird welt thing on his eye. Like, just came out of nowhere after that experience. So it was just, you know, it's unexplained. We don't know what it was. We tried to look to see if it was, like, a bite or anything like that, but you can usually see, like, you know, anyone that's been bit by a bug or spider, you can see, like, there's a hole and then it gets inflamed around it, but there was nothing like that at all. So we really couldn't explain what it was happening, and, you know, he felt it for sure.
Well, it's interesting too, because you mentioned that Ramirez kind of laughing at you, because he had kind of a really dark, macabre sense of humor that he would use even when he was in court being tried and all that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, he was definitely I don't know, maybe like a cocky kind of, kind of cocky guy.
He would lunge at the guards and, you know, yell "Hail Satan" and just creepy type stuff like that with a smile on his face
to the media and everything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. So it makes sense that he was kind of, he probably liked it. He was like, "All right, you guys filming, you want me? Here I am. I'll show myself." And, you know,
it's interesting. So you're just saying just his essence would be there, because it's not like he died there,
right?
Or his soul is trapped there. But yet you're saying that his essence was there, his spirit was there.
Yeah, I mean, it's all theoretical in a way, but, you know, the theory that, like, I don't necessarily believe, you know, like a lot of movies and stories show, like, oh, you die there and you die in a house, like you're trapped in that house kind of thing.
Right.
I don't necessarily believe that. I think of a lot of it, honestly, comes to what you personally believe. You know, if you think, oh, I'm going to be trapped here, then you die, then you probably would be trapped there. Mm. You know, but for someone like Richard Ramirez, you know, being so dark, you know, I believe that, you know, there is the possibility that spirits can roam around, but not only just that, but they'll go to places that maybe were, you know, if you're a ghost and you die, you know, I would want to go to places that I liked, you know, places that I felt were like the peak of my life.
Good point, yeah.
Like I want to go back to certain houses and certain areas. So it would make sense that Rich Ramirez, you know, he, you know, probably liked living at the Cecil. It was LA. It was endless amounts of people. You could just go outside and, you know, it's such a packed city, and being right there in downtown and this little hotel that was kind of notorious, so we could get away, kind of fly under the cover of it all.
Well, especially if it had such a dark vibe to it. Like you mentioned, being the suicide hotel, that would attract somebody like Ramirez for sure.
Absolutely. And then and who knows if he's doing rituals and things and conjuring, you know, trying to conjure Satan or demons or whatever he was doing, you know, that could leave kind of a portal or, you know, some kind of saturation of energy there as well, you know, where maybe he can be attached to it and come back and forth. Or even maybe if it's not him directly, but it's just a bit of his energy that's still there, that's, and it's just so evil, it can actually manifest and basically still wreak havoc.
All right, Jay, what else did you discover at the haunted Cecil?
So yeah, I mean, we spent, you know, a lot of times, there was, I remember one point, it was cool, we brought in another psychic friend of ours, Patty, who, once again, we didn't tell her anywhere we were going. And this, you know, for one example, this is when we're kind of, you know, there's so many stories, so we're like, all right, let's go to this room. We know what happened. Mm-hmm. She doesn't. There was, so we took her to a room where this very violent rape and murder happened. She has no idea. She goes in there. She's just kind of standing there. She's like, okay. She's like, oh. We're like, what's wrong? She's like, oh, like, I don't know. I could say it on camera. And we're like, no, it's okay. Whatever. It's fine. She's like, no, like down there, like something's going on down there. Like, it's like hurting. And we're like, really? Like, you know, and she was
like in her private parts.
Yeah, like she was kind of embarrassed to say it because, you know, being on television and stuff. But we're like, no, it's okay. Go ahead, tell us. You know, and that was the exact spot where a woman was brutally raped and murdered.
Wow.
And it was just kind of like, that was just one of many little moments that was just like, wow. Like,
and she didn't know?
No, she had no idea. And there's no way. Like, yeah, maybe you know of certain stories because it's the Cecil and it's pretty famous, but like, you know, it was basically like rolling the dice. We're like, all right, there's 15 floors. We're going to take you to a few random rooms and just see what you pick up on. You know, so I don't see there's any way that she would know exactly what happened in there.
Well, there was another thing too. Wasn't she getting really freaked out next to a window?
Yeah. Yeah, it was during a window. And I remember we called an SLS figure with her while she was actually, you know, kind of freaking out and like feeling something there. And Zach pulled the SLS out, which basically uses infrared laser grid to map, you know, the area, and a figure appeared right onto her and was kind of like, you know, kind of, and we find this a lot when people are getting affected or they're feeling things, we'll shoot the SLS and it's an amazing device. And you'll actually see a figure kind of on top of them or on their shoulders or, you know, with their arm out reaching to them, like actually making physical contact with them.
Okay, so I can back that up because when I mentioned being in the bayous of Louisiana where I had that really strange feeling, we kind of walked a little bit away from the gravesite and I got filmed by what you said, the SLS. I saw it was like a stick figure that you see my stick figure, like a, you know, body, but it's very much a stick figure, like a hangman.
Yeah.
If you're playing the game Hangman, and right next to me is a little, it's like something out of a Disney movie or something. It's morphing and it's moving and I didn't have the same fear as I had. It was more kind of a, not comedy, but just kind of like whimsical kind of,
yeah,
you know, but I saw it with my own two eyes. I'm like, what the hell is that? And it's like, this is the SLS. So I can back that up and vouch for that. But that's the actual thing that happens.
Yeah. And that device is pretty wild because we've shot it. We've run it for hours and hours and nothing shows up. And then we've had it on command, like, oh, is anyone here? And then all of a sudden a figure will appear. And then not only does it appear, we'll wave, and then you'll see its hand wave back at us or something like that.
Yeah, and that, like I said, this thing happened very quickly. So what is the significance of that? That's actually some kind of a spiritual entity that's...
Yeah, I mean, it's unexplained because basically what it's doing, it's mapping the area. So it knows what's there. It's using infrared, basically like 3D mapping technology. So it's mapping, and that's the thing, there'll be nothing there, but it's programmed to know human forms, things like that. And that's what the stick figure appears as when it senses a human form. So you'll shoot it and then, you know, nothing will be there. But if something passes through and the stick figure appears, but like there's no human standing there, or if there is a human, then maybe the stick figure appears next to him or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. So it's totally unexplainable. Like that shouldn't happen.
Did Patty see anything else?
She had a lot of, she was feeling that. I think those were the two main ones that stuck out, at least in my mind, that, you know, were pretty much like, wow, like she got that spot on, you know.
Did you search for the other serial killer, Urchwicker?
Yeah, they. I know Zach, Aaron, and Billy did that this second main investigation night. We split up, and they were focusing more on him, and I actually got sent down into the basement of the Cecil by myself for the entire night. So so I don't know too much of exactly what they experienced personally, at least, you know. But
well, I think from watching the show is that they found his room and a sink turned on.
Oh, right. That was the sink. Okay, that was the sink room. Yep. Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
I remember.
Tell us about the you remember what?
Yeah, because one, these rooms are small, so like you can pretty much see everything that's going around in the room. And we have, when we film, we put cameras everywhere because when we do get some big evidence, we want to show it from every angle. We don't want to be like, oh, maybe it was something over there.
Right,
we can't
right,
see it.
Right,
there's
right.
no cameras. So we put cameras everywhere. And they were filming in there. Nothing's, you know, they're having their experience, nothing major. And out of nowhere, the faucet turns on and just water starts pouring out. And you can clearly see that it wasn't on prior, you know, like literally seconds before it wasn't on. He's been in there for a while. It's not turned on. And then all of a sudden it just full on turns on. And it's not something that like, oh, it was loose. It just, you know, we all know sinks. Like they don't just pop on like that.
Yeah.
You know, the only time I've ever seen that is like when something freezes and your garden hose busts open or something like that, which it definitely wasn't that because it was very hot. I think we were in there like August, September. It was hot and humid. So there's no way. And like you actually had to physically turn that. So that was pretty cool. And definitely, you know, when something's moving on itself, that lends to poltergeist activity because just, you know, there's just no reason that should be happening, you know. But that's one of the Holy Grail things when you catch something that moves by itself or something like that.
Well, and it's so interesting too because one of the things with the documentary that's so really kind of disgusting is that is the people that those poor people from England that were staying and everything, all these terrible things happened. They're turning on the sink and the sink isn't working and there's no water pressure. And that's when we find out that Elisa's body was in the water tank basically sucking up the drain and just like, oh, they're like, we were showering in it, we were drinking it. It's just like, oh
man, I would lose my mind.
Yeah, it's corpse water, right? So you mentioned that you were in the basement. So what, hold on a second here. So they you show up and you got your call sheet and it's like, okay, Zach is on floor 15 and Jay, you're in the basement tonight. Like, are you warned about this?
I drew the short straw of this one. I mean, yeah, kind of. I mean, the thing with us is that we, you know, we don't really do, like, it's not like a traditional filming where you have the call sheets and you have it planned out.
Right, of
like,
course.
It's literally, like, we have full reign. The four of us just kind of, you know, we'll sit down. We'll be like, all right, what should we do? How should we do this? What should be our plan of attack? You know, we don't have producers or the network that's telling us what to do or to redo things or anything like that. You know, it's literally just the four of us. That's why I shoot the show as well. And, you know, like, I'm behind camera and then run in front. And, you know,
you guys are doing everything.
Yeah. Because like, we want to keep it, you know, as contained and controlled as possible.
So the four of you, it's like someone's got to go in the basement and do you say, I'll do it? Or is it kind of like, I mean, you're the new guy? Or
it kind of varies. You know, I guess after 11 years, I'm still the new guy, but
right.
But yeah, I mean, part of me loves it. It's still terrifying. Don't get me wrong. But like, I kind of like it because it's like, all right, if someone's going to do it, someone's got to do it. So
right.
Why not? I'll do it, you know, and, you know, So I went down and it was one of those things. I'm always nervous. I'm always kind of like hesitant. I'm like, all right, really? Like, is there any better ideas? Like, is there any, you know, like, and yeah. I'm thinking like, oh, maybe, can I pitch something else to do? Like something that might be better, you know, but ultimately it's like, all right, I'll do it. Let's do it. You know, that's what we're here for. We're here to explore this stuff and have experiences.
So do you go down by yourself or is there a cameraman with you? Are you the cameraman at this point?
I'm the cameraman. It's 100% just by myself, which just from a production standpoint is kind of tedious and annoying. And plus I decided I wanted to do something special. So I actually brought a reel to reel tape recorder, you know, not like the little digital, like a big heavy with a, you know, actually reel to reel recorder. And plus like carrying like three cameras so I could set up some static wides, things like that, you know, and it's kind of like Survivor Man. You walk down the stairs, you set up a camera, you walk down the stairs, you go up, you get it, you put it down, you walk some further, you know, and during that time, you know, there's these experiences. And I remember getting to a point kind of early on, you know, in the base, I mean, any basement's creepy, honestly. I feel like
that's sure. Probably.
Basements and attics, for some reason, that's something that's always just super creepy.
Well, they're enclosed spaces, so we're, you know, there's not as much place to escape and that sort of thing.
And they're like, they're dirty, they're kind of grimy, there's junk everywhere. you know, so I was down there by myself, and I remember just walking around, and I just felt this constant, like, something's behind me, something's kind of that feeling like something's around every corner, you know, and it was kind of like, there was actually a pretty big basement, but it was very maze-like in a lot of different rooms, and, you know, you walk into boiler rooms and things like that, and it was just, I was just under this constant feeling like things were watching me, like I was, like, being stalked in a sense, you know, like I'm down there hunting ghosts, but actually something else is hunting me. It was kind of that feeling. And then I remember I got to a point where I found, like, an old break room for the workers, and I was like, all right, this feels kind of safer, so I'm going to sit in here for a minute. And I kind of made that, like, a little base camp and did some recordings and tried to communicate. And, you know, unfortunately, nothing too major evidence-wise came through, but that was definitely more of a, you know, personally for me, that was just a scary, you know, just that feeling of, like, anytime something's going to happen. And then, I don't know, I don't think it actually made the special, but towards the end there, I remember I felt like something finally was, like, I heard footsteps coming up behind me, and it's pitch black too. Like, you got to remember that when we're in there,
you can't see anything. Oh, you
can't
wow.
see anything. We don't have lights on. The only thing we could see to get by is actually on the monitor of the camera, because it's seeing in night vision. So that's all we really have to go by. And, you know, when you hear footsteps running up behind you and you're in the pitch black and can't see anything, I just took off. I just started running. And I remember running, and I was like, all right, like, I've been down here all night. Like, it's, I'm done. Like, this is good enough. And I remember running, and I got to, there was an elevator that went all the way down, and I got to the elevator. I'm just hitting the buttons, and I just keep hearing these footsteps, like, running towards me. I was like, I don't care. I don't know what it is. I want to get out of here. You know, like, I've had enough. And I remember hopping in the elevator and just shut the door and went up real quick. And then I think I got up there, and it opened up, and I think I saw Aaron first, and he was like, oh, yeah, we're wrapping out. We're done. And I was like, all right, I'm done too. Let's get out of here.
Well, I'd be freaking myself out. You know what I mean? Like you said, like, if the footsteps were running up behind you, I mean, I would be envisioning a million different things that are going to end in my demise.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, you know, obviously it's like, all right, I want to document evidence, but ultimately too, I want to, you know, save my ass as well.
Well, yeah, of course. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I was just looking through kind of some reports. There actually was some audio of Jack Unterweger. And I don't know if you remember this, but one of the investigators asked the spirit of the serial killer Jack Unterweger who he had touched, and the response was, "Your mom."
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So this guy's got a sense of humor to him.
I don't
know.
Maybe it's just these serial killers. Just they're a little cocky about it. I guess they want to.
So you actually hear that? I think it says your mom.
Yeah, I remember hearing that. Yeah, which is weird because it's like we've gotten that before. We're like, you know, it's funny because we've gotten evidence. We've gotten some amazing EVPs, amazing evidence that are people like cursing us out, and it's like, sorry, TV world, you can't hear this because it's gonna be a big beep over it. But it's incredible, and we'll play it anyway. And it's just like beep, you know, something like that.
Now, what does EVP stand for?
Electronic voice phenomena. So it's basically when you record, and like right now, if, you know, we're talking, and obviously this is being recorded, and we're like, hey, is anybody here? It's silent. There's nothing there. We play this back now, and in between that, when that's quiet, and I say, is anyone here? You'll hear a voice saying, I am, or get away, or whatever it is, help, or something, you know, like a voice will come through and be on the recording.
So how do you explain that?
I mean, the logical explanation for me that helps me sleep at night is kind of a little what I touched on earlier, how, you know, I know as human beings, we're all made up of energy. You know, we know that for a fact. We all have energy. And I think there's good energy and there's bad energy. And I think it makes sense that when you die, a little piece of that energy of you can still linger around and kind of still be in the spaces where you occupy. And then under the right variables, the right circumstances, with the right, you know, technology, the right timing, you can experience that. You can capture a little bit, like almost like a record player just on a loop, just kind of going over this energy is just, you know, going back and forth. So we go and we capture a bit of, you know, we record, you know, that helped me. Maybe that's something someone yelled with so much passion and so much energy at one point that it's still kind of lingering there. So that makes sense to me. And that, you know, is the easy kind of like, all right, that's calm, you know. But then when we get those direct responses, like I remember we've gotten stuff before where we're at a certain location. One that always sticks out was when we were at the Riviera Hotel in Vegas before they tore it down. And we're in there and we say, where are we? And clear as day, you hear Riviera comes through. And it's like, all right, so now this is something that's actually communicating with us. This shows a level of intelligence. This shows, you know, it's
answering
not,
your question.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that means that there's something that's actually there. It's not just a loop of energy. And that's the one that kind of makes it a little more difficult to sleep at night, especially when we experience these things over right. and over again.
All right, Jay, you mentioned that you guys were on lockdown at the Cecil. What exactly does that mean and what exactly does that entail?
So we call it the lockdown because when we do the actual official lockdown investigation, I guess to back up, our show basically is kind of split in two parts. The first part is we focus more on the interviews and, you know, the research, telling the stories, things like that. And we film that with the lights on. We have our, you know, our bigger production cameras that we shoot that with. And then we have a sound guy with us. We have, you know, our production manager there and things like that to kind of help out with that shooting. But then when we do the second half of the show, which is strictly just the investigation, everyone leaves. It's just the four of us. So we call it lockdown because it's like we're locked in, just the four right. of us. Any other production staff, you know, anyone else, they're all outside. They all go out there. Anyone in the building's all cleared out. And it's just the four of us by ourselves in there for the entire night.
Wow. So you guys said you did a 10-day shoot, basically, at the Cecil. Did you find any other evidence or anything else that happened there?
I think that was the major thing. I mean, like I said, it's like, you know, you spend so much time doing it and it's, you know, there's only so much time we can show everything. And a lot of the time it's tough, like we kind of touched upon, is like it's a lot of it's personal. It's personal feelings, personal experiences, right. which is hard to translate on camera. You know, probably when I freaked out and ran out of the basement on the elevator, it probably didn't make the show because I was probably just running and the camera didn't see it, you know? So, you know, it's not necessarily right. for that.
Well, that sort of thing too. People that aren't there go, oh, he's just making it up. You know what I mean? Like there's not as much physical hold in your hand evidence, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's tough. That is the part to you know, it's hard to translate to the audience, you know, and that's why when we do get actual visual or audio evidence, we try to, you know, we try to debunk it. We try to disprove it at first. We try to like, all right, how could this happen? And then
right.
we'll look at every camera angle and try to look at every point of view and try to figure out how this could happen. And then we've caught amazing evidence before in the past where, you know, maybe it was just on like one camera, just on the side. And we're like, oh, maybe it could have been this, but like, you know, we know it's not, but like, because of the camera angles, we just don't show it because we don't want to, you know, we only want to try to present, you know, the best that we can.
So I guess as we start to wind down, the Cecil, when you went in there and kind of the evidence that you found and the feelings that you had, is it one of the more haunted places you've been into or is it average or?
I think it's definitely more than average. It's definitely, I don't know. I mean, we've been so many places. I don't want to say it's necessarily the haunted, but it's 100% haunted. Like, there's no doubt in my mind that place is haunted. You could feel it the minute you walk in there, every floor. Like, there was no escape. There was no moment where it was just like, all right, like, this is a chill area. This is cool. This is calm. You know, like, oh, you know, let's take a break and get some water. It's like, we're going outside. Like, we went out to Skid Row to take a break. Like, when we wanted to take a break, you know, grab some chips, grab some water or something. We went outside into Skid Row. Like that tells you how bad it is right. in that hotel.
That's way more scarier out there, you would think.
Yeah. But it was like, all right, we got to like just stepping out, get some, you know, quote unquote fresh air, I guess, as much as it can be there. But, you know.
So what do you think it is about the Cecil Hotel that makes it that way?
I mean, I think it's just the long history, you know, of just negativity. It's just, you know, we all know negativity builds. It builds, you know, on our day-to-day lives. You know, it's kind of like, you know, there's a human, you know, kind of collective consciousness where, like, you know, if you're around people in a bad mood, you're going to be in a bad mood, things like that. And
right.
I think this is a place that's just, unfortunately, from almost its beginning, it's just been steeped in negative energy. And it can't escape it. It's just one thing after another. And even to most recently with the Elisa Lam case, you know, we've talked about, you know, there's, you know, no, I don't think we found any direct evidence, but we've theorized that, you know, maybe it's something even just with the land before LA was even a city, you know, who knows? A lot of the land was sacred, things like that, you know, that, you know, you kind of look at, you know, like a, the strip club from Dusk Till Dawn, like at the end of the movie,
right.
like the club is on top of like an Aztec temple, you know?
Yeah.
Like who knows what was there way back in the day. And if someone, you know, whoever was living there, like, made it sacred, and people come in and just tear it up. Like, you know, it's kind of the, I guess, the downside of things. And, you know, such a major city like LA too, like, it has destroyed the earth in a sense and kind of changed that landscape forever. You know, it's gone from, you know, LA is a beautiful place with the hills and the countryside, but you go downtown LA and it's cement. It's just a big cement block that's going to forever change the earth. So, I mean, you could argue that alone is enough to kind of create a little bit of a, you know, kind of a weird energy there.
It's interesting too, because they tried so hard to refurbish it and revamp it and put a new coat of paint on it. You know, they just stay on Main or whatever the kind of the offshoot hotel was, where they were trying to separate from the low rent housing where all the junkies lived, and then high end hotel. Like, it just, like, it just, it can't work.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I'm kind of curious, 'cause I mean, when we were there, they were saying that they were starting to do some renovations, and I guess they're planning to try to revamp it once again, which, I mean, I wish them luck. I mean, I don't know if it's at a point where they just tear it down and build something new, which, even if that would even work, who knows?
But you know, is it one of those things, Jay, that now with all kind of the extra publicity, because between your show, which a lot of people watch, and then of course the Netflix, which everyone's into, that people would go there because they want to stay there?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, you know, I feel, I don't know, it's kind of almost like when I've thought about this before, where, like, you know, we put so much light onto this stuff, you know, and is that really a good thing? Right, like, yeah, does that actually, like, the more people become aware of it, the more, does that fuel it? Does that increase it? Does that make it even stronger? Like, you know, kind of, is it better to just forget about these things and just let it dwindle away in history? I don't know. I guess that's the debate. But at the same time, we want to learn this stuff. We experience it. We do this stuff because we truly love doing it. You know, we're lucky enough that, you know, we have a TV show to be able to do it for, but we ultimately do it because we love it. You know, when, you know, we're not on the road, we're talking about the next one, we're planning, we can't wait to get back out and keep going.
Is there any places like the Cecil that you want to get into that you haven't had a chance to yet?
I think so. A couple of mine, I have two spots that I've always wanted to go to. One is actually over in Japan, in the Suicide Forest.
Oh yeah.
I always just thought that would just be such a cool place. I mean, I don't know, I guess I shouldn't use the term cool, it's kind of sad, but, you know, for me, people that investigate the paranormal, I think it would be cool. It would be, you know, such
For the same area, just this, it's a forest where people literally go to hang themselves.
Exactly. So, like, to be able to just, even just spend one night in there just to experience the energy and try to document evidence there, I would love to go there. And then there's a place in, where is it, in the Czech Republic, I believe, that there's like this cathedral that's entirely made out of human bones.
Oh wow.
I forget the name of it, but I've always wanted to go to that place. I remember learning about it a long time ago. I was like, oh man, that's just so cool. It reminded me, you know, I got to go to the catacombs once with Zach many years ago, and we climbed through a mass grave like 300 feet under Paris. And
oh my gosh,
ever since there, I've just always heard about this like chapel temple place in the Czech Republic that's just, and it just sounds incredible.
It's called the Sedlik Ossuary.
That's it, yep.
Inside the Czech Church of Bones. It's adorned with 40,000 human skeletons.
Jeez. Right.
Sure, you'd find some adventures there for sure.
But yeah.
Last question for you. What's the creepiest or scariest experience that you've had since you've been doing the show?
There's been so many, but I think one that always sticks in my mind personally, from a personal standpoint, was I was in this old saloon in Prescott, Arizona, and the people that worked there felt that there was an evil entity that was in the basement that was kind of residing out of this crawl space that was like under the old saloon. Mm-hmm. And once again, I got sent down there by myself and I crawled into the crawl space. So now I'm on my belly, crawling, you know, pulling my elbows, pulling me through this crawl space, trying to call out, it's something evil. So now I'm stepping it up a little. I'm like, all right, you know, I'm you know, standing up to the bully spirit. I'm like calling it out. I'm like, all right, do something. Come on. Like, where you're at, nothing's really happening. So I get more and more aggressive, trying to call it out. Still, even just saying this, it still blows my mind. I'm there. I have one camera in my hand, kind of in front of me. Something grabs my legs. I start kicking. There's nothing there. It pulls me backwards about 3 or 4 feet. I drop the camera. You see on camera, I get pulled backwards away from camera. You could see that there's nothing behind me, and I'm actually getting pulled away from camera. I lose my shit. I start freaking out. The problem is I'm in a crawl space on my belly. I can't just jump up and run. I can't get away. I'm down, trying to process everything that's happened. I'm just yelling. And then I hear Aaron, you know, he was kind of over in some other part of the basement. He comes running over, and I see his flashlight. He pulls out, and I can kind of see where I crawled in. And he's just like, what happened? I'm like, I have no idea. Someone grabbed me. Still, it just takes a while to process it. And I remember I slowly, eventually got my way, crawled myself back out. And the hardest part is, too, is like, all right, that just happened. But now I also have to try to explain it on camera to make the audience understand what I just experienced and what was going on. And, you know, I'm out of breath. I'm just, you know, and I have no idea. And every time I watch that footage, it still just, it blows my mind. Like, I don't, you know, I felt something physically grab me and pull me back. Like, and I've been scratched before. I've seen things lift off the ground and flying by themselves. I've seen exorcisms and possessions and all kinds of things like that. But like when something physically grabs you and moves you, that's like, all right, that's a whole other level that, you know, thankfully, you know, haven't full on. Well, I guess not necessarily moved me, but I did actually just recently, a few weeks ago, I was on an investigation and I felt something grab my knee, which, you know, it wasn't as I felt evil as what pulled me in that saloon, but it was probably, you know, it's been a while since I actually felt like a physical touch of something that's not there, which that just, it's crazy, man.
Yeah, like you said, that's next level. I mean, I've heard the scratching and the, you know, the grip marks and choke marks, but actually pulling you, that's out of, you know, The Conjuring or something along those lines.
It can kind of almost play into the Cecil. Like if thing, you know, I know that there's energy, there's spirits that are powerful enough to do that. The Cecil would be a place that has that kind of energy. It's there. You could feel it. Like there's no doubt there could be spirits there that have enough energy and enough ability to actually physically move people, which could, you know, have literally pulled Elisa Lam, maybe helped her climb up.
Yeah, man. It's a lot of creepy stories there, but, dude, great talking to you today, man. And I'd love to have you come back on to tell some more stories at some point.
Absolutely. We got so many. We got a whole lot more coming out, too. And you know, like I said, it's our life, man. Well, we love it. So
be safe, man. Next time the ghost pulls you, just try and reach back and slap it away or something.
Hopefully next time we talk, I'm not just like shaking in a corner or something.
Turning a light on and off. Thanks, Jay.
All right. Thanks, man. Have a good one.